Hello, and welcome to the Reopening Hospital Service Lines, a Playbook for Moving Forward, Part 1 webinar presented by Pulcinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions for our speakers regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 support email. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the technical support box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulcinelli shareholder Bragg Hemme.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to part one of Pulcinelli's two-part series on reopening of hospital service lines. We hope to provide you with relevant and timely material today related to resuming service lines in your hospitals, but we realize that this information is changing somewhat constantly, both at the federal, state, and local level. And so please, as Emma mentioned, please refer back to our blog, which provides up-to-date guidance both at the federal and state level. And reach out to our COVID-19 interdisciplinary team with any specific questions you have given the area that you are in. As Emma mentioned, my name is Bragg Hemme. I'm a shareholder in Pulcinelli's Denver office in the healthcare group. And with me today are Andrew Kripe, the Employment Advice and Investigations Practice Group Chair, Neil Shaw, shareholder in our healthcare group, Eric Martin, an associate in our healthcare group. And today we are going to be covering the guidelines published by CMS, state and local, some of the state, county, and local guidance and third-party decision-making tools, and then starting to go over some operational considerations for resuming non-emergent care in your facilities. And then on Wednesday, in our second part, we will go into more detail about some of the other operational considerations and financial considerations to think of. And with that, I will turn it over to Eric to discuss the CMS guidelines.
Thank you, Bragg. So as many of you know, about 2 weeks ago on April 19th, CMS issued new updated guidelines and recommendations for reopening facilities to provide non-emergent, non-COVID-19 healthcare, kind of setting off the starting pistol that kind of started several state actions, similarly reopening the opportunity to start these non-emergent elective procedures again. And the CMS guidelines kind of set out, based off of the gating criteria that was issued by the Trump administration on April 16th, a series of standards that hospitals and healthcare providers should consider prior to reopening services. So the first is kind of a downward trajectory, a sustained downward trajectory over a 14-day period, so over 2 weeks, of both reported symptoms, including influenza-like symptoms, as well as any kind of of the known COVID symptoms, as well as a downward trajectory of documented cases. And that could be either a downward trajectory of documented cases themselves or a downward trajectory of positive tests as a percentage of all of the tests completed, assuming that the number of tests being done continues to be at the same level or increases. Obviously, if testing decreased and the number went down, that would throw off the kind of statistical balance there, and so it wouldn't be a clear downward trajectory from that. If there's a downward trajectory, then kind of the next thing to consider for hospitals is whether or not hospitals in the region, not just the individual hospital or facility itself, but hospitals in the region generally are able to treat patients without reverting to crisis standards of care. And for those of you who aren't familiar with crisis care, crisis standards of care, what that generally means is just simply that without the hospital or the hospital system in the region being so overwhelmed by the pandemic that it's not possible for it to provide normal standard levels of care to its patients. And so that's where, you know, you all remember seeing things of providers needing to constantly reuse PPE or resorting to using, you know, vacuum cleaner bags or cloth face masks or things that are not medical grade PPE. And then also any of the points like we saw in Italy where there is actually kind of complex decisions being made about who gets what services and when. So hospitals need to be able to treat patients basically with a standard level of care that we would expect absent the pandemic prior to restarting non-emergent care. And finally, the last kind of standard that the CMS guidance laid out was that there was a robust testing program in place for at-risk healthcare workers to make sure that healthcare workers are being both tested and screened to prevent the kind of continued spread of COVID-19 among patients and among staff. Once though that kind of general gating level is, that gating criteria is passed, a hospital can, in consultation with kind of state and local regulations and health administrations, can start to consider reopening non-emergent care. The CMS provides a lot of additional kind of considerations that hospitals should keep in mind when considering both to restart care as well as which care to provide. Because I think it's important to remember that this isn't a one-time assessment. These gating criteria need to be continuously met. So if you saw another upswing in COVID cases, a hospital would want to scale back and kind of reassess at each given time. And so it should be considered a number of different items. With that, CMS still strongly recommends and encourages providers to, as much as possible, continue using alternative care methods, including telehealth, virtual check-ins, remote monitoring, triaging patients to alternative non-COVID locations or COVID zones of a hospital, and then continually assess individual cases, both for necessity and prioritization. So that means looking at, you know, the clinical need and indication of the patient, how high risk are they, what their acuity level is, but also the current resource levels of the availability of resources, both in terms of PPE and medical supplies, but also the amount of resources that the individual procedure or surgery is going to require and what impact that would have on the reserves. Because within the CMS guidance, they want to make sure that hospitals are continually evaluating that if they're doing elective services, they could still manage to respond to another surge if there is one, if we see another spike in cases, the hospitals don't overextend themselves by doing these non-emergent elective services and suddenly aren't able to, you know, address a crisis if that reemerges. And so if you cast your minds back all the way to April 6th, which seems both simultaneously like yesterday and a year ago, CMS released additional recommendations that kind of set out a tiered prioritization system. And within that, you know, high complexity conditions, chronic disease management, and other high acuity conditions were prioritized over lower acuity services. And hospitals should continue to work within that kind of framework of prioritizing those high complex, high acuity services and surgeries prior to kind of focusing on lower acuity services. And there is several other third-party kind of scoring tools and clinical decision-making tools that have been put out that colleague Neil Shaw will be talking about more shortly that provide additional guidance in making some of these considerations. And it's important, the phase one guidance from CMS is just that, it's guidance. And they're really kind of a framework of recommendations that sets the tone for when to start thinking about reopening and what kind of the baseline threshold should be for hospitals to consider that. But it leaves a significant amount of discretion both in the hands of providers and hospital systems as well as the states to determine when and which services can resume of kind of non-emergent services and non-COVID related treatments. And the CMS guidance lays out a number of considerations to look at when reopening and for establishing case prioritization. So obviously, first and foremost, that's been in the news is kind of just availability and continued conservation of personal protective equipment. That again, CMS wants to make sure that when hospitals start care again, that they're not overextending themselves and no longer able to respond to the ongoing pandemic, because we all know it's not gone, but some areas are more stable than others and able to start treating patients again. So as long as there's a available PPE, then the hospital should be in good stead. Similarly, they want to make sure that there's availability of workforce across the phases of care. So that means not just, you know, that there's the workforce available for the individual surgery or procedure itself, but also thinking about the preoperative steps, the postoperative care and, you know, post-discharge care and planning as well, that each of those phases of care can be covered and that there's workforce and PPE and space available for each of those phases of care, because you wouldn't want to move a patient through and then run into a roadblock where you no longer have staff or PPE available to continue treatment. And that kind of goes into facility readiness as well. And we'll be talking more about the different steps and measures that hospitals and healthcare providers can take to make sure that their facility is ready to restart non-emergent and elective services, as well as kind of making sure that there's medical supply availability. And then again, that testing capacity is robust enough that can test, identify, and prevent continued spread of COVID-19. And again, this leaves a lot of discretion both up to the providers, but as well as to the states themselves. And so digging into the states a little bit more, I'll hand it off to my colleague, Neil Shaw, who's going to kind of break down some of the state considerations that providers should be thinking about.
Thanks, Eric. This is Neil Shaw, I'm an attorney in the healthcare group here in Chicago. As Eric said, the CMS guidance is incredibly persuasive and is important to keep in mind, but it is ultimately just guidance. The legal requirements associated with reopening facilities or reopening certain service lines at facilities really lies at the state level. And, you know, CMS recognizes that governors have the ultimate authority to decide whether to reopen certain service lines or certain services in hospital facilities. So while the CMS guidance is very persuasive and you should consider its requirements, you really need to be sure that as hospital services reopen, they are in compliance with any state legal requirements. Those requirements are very diverse, and states have taken a broad range of actions to restrict or limit the kinds of care that has been provided in hospitals currently. So you really need to look at the terms of any state regulations or executive orders or other kinds of emergency provisions that are in place. And you should consider whether there are local rules or county rules or other kinds of restrictions or limitations that would apply to your facility in each specific geographic region. Just to give you an idea of the variation in state and local guidance, there is a broad range of regulatory requirements, and they vary very significantly from state to state. Hospital facilities should consider things like whether a state includes restrictions on professional liability. So, for example, states like Illinois expressly tie professional liability protections to compliance with guidance that was released by the Illinois Department of Public Health. There may be other kind of implied linkages between professional liability concerns and specific state guidance. The state guidance often places the healthcare facilities in the position of weighing different considerations of clinical necessity, preventable harm to patients, and system preparedness for future or ongoing COVID-19 protections. That gives hospitals a certain degree of flexibility, which is positive, but it also puts a great deal of pressure on them to balance these risks in a way that doesn't leave them exposed to future liability for professional liability concerns or facility liability concerns. And then depending on the state and local rules, they may impose specific requirements on entities for example, maintaining certain levels of PPE, equipment, beds, other kinds of supplies, or implementing other kinds of facility readiness operational processes, which we'll discuss here in a moment. So the bottom line here is that hospitals ultimately still have their significant levels of responsibility to determine whether or not to provide certain services to certain patients. Along those lines, there is an increasing number of third-party tools that have been released. Some states require the use of these tools, others don't require them, but in many cases, it's at least important to look to these tools because they're growing in importance as well-regarded ways to balance whether or not a particular patient requires a particular elective procedure. And these tools you'll see are a little bit overlapping in their requirements, at least currently, but we'll see what happens as the state of these third-party tools continues to evolve. Some of the more common ones currently are the American Hospital Association's roadmap along with the American College of Surgeons, American Society of Anesthesiologists, and a Nursing Association to resume elective surgeries. And so that reflects a lot of the CMS guidance, but also adds additional considerations specific to elective surgical procedures and balancing patient characteristics, facility characteristics, and these kinds of preparedness characteristics. The American College of Surgeons has also published a toolkit and a specific tool to use to assess whether individual patient characteristics and the type of procedure that is contemplated is actually low risk given the status of the COVID-19 epidemic in each region. And that also incorporates elements of this University of Chicago medically necessary time-sensitive prioritization tool. Again, other tools may be evolving, but entities should look to the tools that are considered credible, that are considered supported by evidence and are adopted by similar facilities. Now, again, state and local orders may require use of a specific tool, so that just underlies the importance of looking to any applicable state or local guidance. Now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Bragg, for a discussion of the availability of PPE.
Great. Thanks, Neil. Yeah, and with that backdrop, we want to go into some of the operational considerations as you consider resuming certain service lines. One of the primary concerns since the beginning of the COVID outbreak has been the availability of PPE, medical supplies, and equipment. And insufficient stock in some instances has led to great concern, complaints, and even lawsuits in some instances by employees and patients. And so we want to really pay attention to this as we think about reopening service lines, because it's important that hospitals are going to be able to ensure sufficient stock of these supplies for their current COVID patient load, any new service lines, and for any potential additional COVID surges. And our ongoing recommendations in line with CDC recommendations are that healthcare providers, staff, and patients wear surgical face masks at all times in the facility, although patients can wear cloth masks if necessary, and that practitioners and staff that are involved with procedures involving mucous membranes must wear respiratory protections, including N95 masks and face shields. And so as we think about these considerations, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. First, for planning purposes, use of the PPE burn rate calculator that's available on the CDC website. And this might be something that hospitals have been using already to manage their supplies during the initial surge of COVID patients. But it is a tool that really helps plan and to optimize PPE use. And we recommend, you know, as with most of these things, that you develop P&Ps specific to this time in our lives. Mandating essentially for your hospital the use of the PPE burn rate calculator in looking to supply chain management and controls. And with respect to supply chain management, really making sure that you have sufficient alternatives to get the supplies that you need. And this may be through your traditional agreements. It may be through other non-traditional vendors that have come up with new and different supplies. And so making sure that people are doing that research and figuring out where you're going to be able to get supplies to keep up the necessary stock that you need. And that part of the policy, related to inventory management, how much supply do you need, how long do you think that supply is going to use, how long do you think it will last, and where you're going to get it, those types of things get updated with respect to these things with each new service line that you add back, just to make sure that you are doing that planning in advance of any new service line being added. Also, and a lot of hospitals have already done this, but putting out clear guidance to their medical staff, practitioners, and staff regarding the use and conservation of PPE, medical supplies, and equipment. This may require greater transparency around what the hospital is doing, how they're managing PPE, medical supplies, and equipment. And it may require you to go through sort of each step of an operative procedure. What supplies should you be using in pre-op versus the actual operative procedure and then post-op? And so that you can manage the supply a little bit better and any reuse implications, that sort of thing. Most other hospitals have already started thinking about other protective options, such as barriers, other physical separation options. You should continue to think about those very seriously as you roll out additional service lines, because it may differ depending on what service lines you're reopening. Reporting mechanisms for staff who don't feel like they have access to the necessary supplies, and then making sure that you are responsive to those concerns. And then also contingency planning. You know, there are obviously many, many reports out there about what COVID is going to do, where it's going to surge next, how many months we have until then. And that will also depend both regionally and at the state level, depending on what level of reopening is in place right now. But you need to be prepared for any shortages that come up. Need to stay on top of CDC and FDA guidelines, for instance, related to extended use and reuse of certain supplies, and consider when and how what the process will be to scale back on reopening service lines should there be a shortage of equipment. And next, I wanted to move on to COVID-19 testing. And this is an area that obviously, you know, everybody's focusing on. The best case scenario is that we could test everybody somewhat frequently, but we just don't have the capabilities yet. And this area of testing is evolving very, very quickly. Like every 5 minutes, I feel like there's something new, both on the manufacturing side, coming up with new tests, FDA's approach to approving tests, and, you know, the type of testing, that type of thing. So this is an area that, while very, very necessary for the safety of, you know, your entire staff and all of your patients, it's important that you roll out testing alternatives in compliance with state and federal laws, which are evolving constantly. The FDA has put in place some new guidance with respect to some of their approved tests, and even if it's not new guidance, I would say that it's coming up with additional clarity on what tests can be used in what settings. So it's important to stay up to date on that because it involves the tests, the reagents, the materials, how to collect, where you can collect, all of those different things, and it is evolving. So with respect to patient testing, certainly, there are existing guidelines in place related to patient screening for potential symptoms prior to entering non-COVID space. And that would include an assessment of potential symptoms, taking temperatures, that type of thing. But the hospital might also want to consider TMPs around testing patients as well. And as I mentioned just a moment ago, this policy would need to be fairly agile because the rapid nature of the evolution of testing and the guidance around it. Prioritization of testing should be made based on exposure risks associated with the procedure, risks of post-op respiratory complications should the patient develop COVID, and any other local or hospital-specific conditions that may be at play with respect to your hospital. Some hospitals may want to institute a 14-day pre-op quarantine. Certainly not required, but depending on the risk you're facing in your region and the importance of, you know, maintaining safety of patients as new service lines open up, that may be the best way to go. You could also consider, you know, depending on how you institute your patient testing model and the timing of getting test results, so it could take several days to get the test results back, you may have a patient go into a testing facility pre-op, you know, 72 hours, let's say, before their procedure, you may ask that the patient quarantine post-test so that you at least know with some level of certainty that that test is accurate when the patient actually arrives at your facility. And with respect to when the test should be done, that will also depend on whether or not you're doing in-house testing, they're going to third-party labs, or you're having them tested their PCP, When they test will also be dependent on what test is used and how long it takes to get the results of those tests. And then also with respect to result reporting, you'll want to have clear guidelines with respect to how it gets reported to the patient, to the patient's treating or ordering physician, state and federal governments, and that should be in line with HIPAA, state and local guidelines as well. With respect to staff testing, Andy's going to cover this to some extent in a bit, but PMP is related to staff. Also, you should have screening procedures required related to symptoms and temperature. If you have a staff member that's symptomatic, certainly running a test and then quarantining the patient. Similar to the patient testing, you should outline whether or not those tests will be done in facility or through their PCP or other testing site. Depending on the availability of testing, the risk at your hospital, the risk associated with each staff member's role in the hospital, you may want to consider policies related to asymptomatic testing. And then consider the necessary authorizations that will be required for that test. And that will depend somewhat on what type of test is being conducted as well, whether you're doing sort of readiness to work testing, which would be sort of antibody-based tests, versus molecular testing, which would be ongoing surveillance of active infections. Also, those policies should outline reporting requirements. Again, keeping in mind HIPAA, state, federal, and local guidance. And then what to do if staff refuse, and this is a better question posed to Andy, who will speak later, but that could certainly influence the staff member's ability to come back to the job if they're refusing to test. And with that, we'll go back to Neil to talk about facility readiness.
Great, thanks, Greg. So as we discussed at the outset, an important element of allowing a hospital to move forward is preparing facilities to receive patients who are outside of an initial COVID-19 surge. And that's a consistent part of the CMS guidance, as well as almost all of the state executive orders at varying levels of specificity. So there's a lot of discretion placed on hospitals as to how they get there. Based on the information included in state guidance, the AHA joint roadmap, and the CMS guidance, we've kind of boiled this down to three large issues. The overarching question is whether your hospital is ready to safely care for these new patients who are returning to receive services in each facility. First, is the facility adequately prepared for a later surge? Emergency preparedness is a consistent issue as each of these facilities and hospitals across the country begin to re-engage in services. Second, how will the facility operationally protect these non-COVID patients? And third, how will your long-term space and infrastructure needs need to change in order to account for ongoing challenges in treating these COVID-19 patients? So first, preparedness issues. Again, this is kind of the backdrop for almost all of these questions of re-engaging in certain other services. Each facility needs to maintain preparedness in case there is an additional surge. Now, the specificity of those requirements varies very broadly, as I've said before. But just to give an illustration, in a state like Illinois, there's a mandatory requirement to reserve about 20% of your capacity, measured in various different ways. In other states, there's no explicit requirement of that kind, but there is a general requirement to just be ready in case there is an additional surge, whether due to environmental factors, seasonality, or just loosening of social distancing regulations and things like that. The lessons that you've learned in addressing the initial surge will come in handy to determine what you need to keep on hand or what a facility needs to keep on hand in order to be ready for a sudden surge, which may present without a lot of advance warning. So that includes things like supplies, particularly PPE, ventilators, beds, particularly ICU beds, but also space to handle an ongoing presentation of a high volume of patients with COVID-19 or potential COVID-19 patients. Along those lines, an increasingly important element of hospital preparedness is having an area designated for triage and screening. Very frequently, that's still in many cases the ED. That may not be appropriate, especially as COVID-19 becomes a little bit of a background issue and something that is prevalent in the population at large. It may make sense to have separate procedures for triage and monitoring of patients before they enter hospital facilities. And then finally, to assist your modeling and to hopefully stay ahead of and give you some runway to prepare for a potential surge, it's important to identify the models that you believe are the most accurate and the most reflective of the actual prevalence of COVID-19 in your region. Separately, there is this issue of physically separating patients who present with COVID-19 or COVID-19-like symptoms from those who are coming to the facility to receive other kinds of elective procedures and elective services. This puts a lot of pressure on hospitals to rethink the way that they're using space. And increasingly, you're going to start to see this kind of parallel track within hospitals where one part of the hospital is reserved for COVID-19 care, while other parts are reverting to providing the entire spectrum of care for other services. That places a lot of pressure on these triage and screening spaces and policies for who is triaged and who is screened. CDC obviously recommends symptomatic screening of all individuals entering the hospital, whether that's patients, staff, vendors, anyone entering the hospital facility really should be receiving some sort of symptomatic screening, temperature checks, and things of that nature. But note that CMS also has expanded its flexibilities under EMTALA so that you can allow screening and triage areas that are not actually on the hospital's campus, such as a remote site like a parking lot, to screen and identify potential COVID-19 patients. Again, states and cities may require additional specific criteria around screening, testing, self-quarantine, infection control. All of those things should be consulted as you implement the process to identify and isolate those potential COVID-19 cases. An increasingly important part of this physical separation policy is cohorting patients, separating out non-COVID-19 patients into these NCC zones, non-COVID care zones. In many cases, these are going to have to be identified and built out. They may or may not be able to be placed in existing patient care space. And in that case, hospitals may have to get creative and start looking at non-traditional space, things like waiting areas, lobbies, atria, I suppose, and considering whether or how they can provide patient care in these areas that were not traditionally established as patient care areas. Now, note that on the Medicare side, CMS has provided flexibilities under these hospitals without walls models to allow the waiver of the provider-based rules and certain under-arrangements rules. So the provider-based rules may apply to hospital space that is not typically treated as patient care space, so things like administration buildings. Under arrangements rules may apply to facilities operated by other operators, such as independent ASCs or freestanding EDs. And then there's the ability for those independent entities to actually enroll in their own right as hospital facilities and operate under a arrangement or a contract with a primary hospital facility to care for non-COVID patients. There is this ongoing debate and dialogue with CMS as to whether this may potentially cover services provided in patient homes. There's going to be more discussion of that in part two of this webinar, but I wanted to at least raise that issue because that potentially could really improve flexibility for hospitals to provide care to patients without risking potential COVID-19 exposure. Now, note that if you are providing care in an alternative care site or a remote site, the provider-based rules, while they're largely waived, CMS still requires the hospital to maintain operational control and compliance with those conditions of participation that are not waived. And so it's important to have some level of direct control or an arrangement providing you control over that kind of provider-based space. If there are financial arrangements needed, for example, a lease for the use of space or payment for services, ensure that you have a good handle on what those look like and that they are compliant with applicable fraud and abuse laws, particularly the Stark Law and the kickback statute if there are governmental patients involved. And then finally, remember that you have the ability to expand your telehealth in ways that have not really been available in the past. And so there may be a role to using telehealth to diverting patients or keeping patients from even having to present in the hospital's facility, while in some cases still billing for hospital services provided to those patients. Another element separate from the physical plant considerations are procedural considerations as to which services should be provided to which patients. CMS and many state requirements call for the establishment of a surgical review committee. This is a formal standing committee, including representation from hospital administration, surgery, anesthesiology, nursing, and potentially other kinds of specialties, depending on the cases that will be treated in each facility. And the responsibility of this new committee is to consider the backlog of cases, clinical considerations for a procedure provided to a particular patient, the kinds of resources and staff that will be required, and characteristics of the patient, such as comorbidity, age, and things like that, which may increase the likelihood of needing an extended inpatient stay. As part of this surgical review committee's responsibility and the hospital's responsibility as a whole, the hospital should monitor epidemiological surveillance data as that continues to evolve and become more accurate, and maintain oversight over the current levels of key supplies. So for example, as you begin to ramp up elective surgeries, what is your PPE supply looking like? Do you need to make changes in your procurement processes, or otherwise do you need to change the decision-making around utilization for these non-COVID cases? And then finally, understand that there may be other capacity issues or management issues that you have to look at. One example here is if you have a lab in your facility that you use, you may need to consider how you're going to manage throughput as testing begins to ramp up and as you begin to potentially test asymptomatic patients or conduct screening tests, which may increase the burden on those service lines. Finally, very quickly on long-term changes, you know, many of these conversions to COVID space and non-COVID space have been done on a fairly rapid ad hoc basis. In many cases, they're using that kind of CMS waiver flexibility, which may or may not be available in the long term. And so there is some incentive to keep an eye on the long term here and consider whether it makes sense to establish more long-term leases, things that are designed to care for patients and separate and cohort out patients for a longer period of time. That may mean a lease of space, that may mean licenses to use space, that may even mean a permanent build out in addition to a hospital's campus. But as hospitals very quickly try to put these places, these spaces in place, they may need to consider whether it makes sense for some of these longer term capital projects to go forward as well. And then again, consider shifting what you can to telehealth for now. I mean, many hospitals are doing that already, but it makes sense to leverage telehealth capabilities to the largest extent possible, because that is always going to be the option that results in the lowest risk of exposure to non-COVID patients. So now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Andrew Kreit to discuss workforce considerations. This is an important part of any hospital coming back online, as you need the people to implement all the policies that we just discussed.
Great, thank you. So as you think about your workforce, I imagine I'm talking to an audience that has been working through this. So what we're thinking about is the workforce that you're bringing back online, as well as making those longer term adjustments as this situation continues, at least for the next year. Just like the guidance is rapidly developing in terms of how to deliver care to patients, we're seeing the exact same thing on the employment front. So I'm going to highlight some sort of basic principles and rules and some things that you should be thinking about in terms of the workforce. But kind of the overriding principle that we've been advising clients when it comes to managing the workforce in the midst of this pandemic is expect the expected. And let me just talk about a few of those points real briefly. First, you should expect that some employees, maybe many employees, are going to resist either returning to work or cooperating with a lot of the measures that are necessary to protect the workforce, whether it's submitting to testing or screening or, you know, any of the, you know, PPE requirements. There is going to be a certain segment of any population, even in the healthcare world, that is just going to be more resistant than others. What we've been finding as we're working with clients through these different situations is that we tend to see better compliance with employees that it's sort of an expected part of their job, whether that's in an emergency room or first responders. You don't tend to see a lot of uncooperative or resistant employees. But as you kind of get deeper into the return to work, as you bring back more service lines, as you bring back administrative personnel, that's where you should expect to see more resistance. And so the most important part in terms of how you manage that resistance is establishing a consistent approach that ensures fairness and really protects against claims of favoritism and discrimination. So, you know, if testing and screening is a required part of doing the job, then the discipline for failing or refusing that testing and cooperation should be consistent. And I'll talk a little bit about the legal rules behind it, but here's some good news. The good news is that employment law seems to be following health law in this situation. Employment law seems to be following common sense. In other words, putting health and safety first is taking precedent, and I'll talk about some specific rules that have come out. Second thing I'll tell you is the law on the employment front hasn't fully evolved. Employers don't yet have immunity of any kind when it comes to claims by employees. There is not a sort of general acceptance that COVID-19 is just out there, and so it's an expected workplace hazard and a hazard anywhere else, so there's no special liability. You know, so the law is still developing there, but so what's going to be key is establishing and continuing to evolve these consistent disciplinary standards. One approach that I've seen and that clients have worked through sort of in the immediate emergency situation has been to put non-cooperative employees on unpaid administrative leave. And that's okay for a period of time, that may be acceptable, but in the long run, that may not be workable. You may not have the staffing levels that you need. You may get people that are sort of doing the copycat Me Too thing to try to get that administrative leave. And originally, I had clients that were following that approach, and it seemed kind of an unappealing thing for employees. But just a word of caution to everybody, something that we have found, and this is going to be an issue more for lower paid employees or employees in facilities and less expensive parts of the country. What we've been finding is that the enhanced unemployment benefits that are available under the federal relief, where employees can get an extra $600 per week, that in some situations it is actually possible for employees to make more money on unemployment. And we have had situations, and we have been seeing an increased number of situations where employees are nervous about going back to work, are put on unpaid administrative leave, turn around and actually file claims for unemployment. And because unemployment agencies are so slammed right now, some of those claims are going through and being approved. So definitely something to keep an eye on, that there is this possible incentive that could work against your staffing levels. And the way to handle that is to first be prepared for it. And you can be prepared for it by explaining our administrative leave process is a process that we're putting people on not against their will, but because they're not ready, willing, or able to work. And in most states, that should disqualify them for unemployment. So if you're seeing that issue, please be on the watch for it, because it can have a really disastrous impact on your staffing levels in short order. All right, let me talk a little bit about some of the specific rules that we're seeing emerging. First, I want to talk about OSHA. OSHA has not done a whole lot at this point. They have not provided a lot of guidance or clarity for employers. For the most part, what they've done is they've said the general duty to provide a safe workplace applies to preventing occupational exposure to COVID-19. And then they've done a fair amount of adopting of CDC guidelines and standards. But what they have not done is provide real clarity around when a COVID-19 case is actually a reportable workplace injury versus when it's not. They have also not done what they've done with seasonal cold and flu, which is to basically exclude it from the reporting requirements. So as it stands right now, there is an OSHA general duty to provide a safe workplace so that COVID-19 cases in the workplace could potentially be workplace injuries and the OSHA rules could apply. Now, on a practical level, I'll tell you, we have been seeing charges brought with OSHA by employees, sometimes by unions that are worried about the situation. The good thing is that we've seen, even though there frankly appears to be a shortage of OSHA investigators, they are working to respond very quickly. So we've seen charges for where there's allegations that there's not enough PPE. And we respond, and we are getting dismissals back from OSHA, which sometimes within 10 to 15 minutes, which is actually pretty remarkable. So what that tells us is the agencies that are responsible for enforcing the workplace laws are really not looking to interfere with healthcare institutions as long as they're making a good faith effort, and that's a positive sign. But you can't take too much comfort in that, because as the pandemic clears, as things ease up a little bit, there's nothing that would prevent OSHA or other agencies from coming back and doing some rigorous second guessing. So that's why we emphasize, you know, the continual evolving nature of everything that you do. On the EEOC front, there's been some helpful guidance that's come out. The EEOC has recognized that employers may require symptom screening. So that can be verbal symptom screening or just visual symptom screening, temperature checks, and testing. There's some big caveats there, though, that I just want to touch on. First, that testing and screening can only be done according to CDC and local health authority guidance. And right now, the CDC is recommending that employers consider symptom screening and temperature checks. It sort of recognizes testing, but as Bragg was saying, there's a lot of ambiguity and a lot still developing on the testing front. Just on the testing front, another issue to be aware of, and I think Bragg mentioned it, the issue of asymptomatic testing. We've seen a little bit of a difference between the experience between our healthcare critical infrastructure clients and our non-healthcare critical infrastructure clients. In the healthcare setting, I think there's sort of this belief that everybody's been exposed because, of course, COVID is in the hospital. And therefore, anybody that gets exposed to a patient is potentially at risk. And as facilities think about establishing the COVID and non-COVID side of the of operations, just one note of caution that we've observed from the non-healthcare setting. And in fact, there's a story this morning in a number of the news sources about this. In the meat cutting or meat processing industry, there was a test done at a particular meat processing plant, and they found 397 asymptomatic employees tested positive. So what that tells us is something I think we've known, but in a really clear way, everybody may look healthy, they may pass your temperature checks, they may pass the symptom screening, but if you are only testing the symptomatic employees, there's still that gaping hole. CDC, OSHA, and EEOC have not provided clear guidance on that, but that's something to really keep an eye on. There's an emerging standard of care, there's emerging information, and it, to the extent you're going to rely on testing as a way to ensure employee safety, really give some serious thought to asymptomatic employee testing along with all others. So a couple other points that are clear from the EEOC and OSHA guidance. The EEOC endorsement of screening and temperature checks and testing does not relieve the employer of any of its other obligations. So the obligation to maintain employee privacy under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a slightly different issue than the HIPAA issue, which applies to institutions in their role as healthcare providers. Under the ADA, an employer still has an obligation to protect the confidentiality of employee health information, maintain it separately from personnel files, so that, for example, if temperature screening is done on a daily basis, or symptom screening or actual testing is done, you wouldn't want those results to be going into employee personnel files. And in fact, you want to be very careful about how communications are handled internally, so that if, for example, an employee is not available, the communication with the manager responsible for that employee needs to be carefully managed, so that you don't have emails or text messages or other sort of non-private forms of communication floating around that reveal confidential information. In terms of the other things that can't be relieved, let's say you do implement the most rigorous screening process possible, and sort of the perfect world that may exist in the near future where you have rapid test results and you're able to rapidly test everybody every single day. It's clear that that still won't relieve an employer from its other obligations or its general duty of care in the OSHA world, because there are some serious questions still, of course, about testing accuracy and reliability. One last point on the testing front, and I don't want to make too much of this, but immunity testing is not yet a thing. It's a question that I get a lot in terms of, can we start establishing a program so that once employees test positive and they return to work, then we can put them, kind of in a situation where they might be more exposed, or can we put them more on the front lines than others? Given the lack of sort of any definitive statement about whether having the disease confers immunity or what that means, that's just not a thing yet. So lastly, I just want to talk about some policy considerations from the HR world that probably have not gotten close review yet, but as this pandemic goes on longer, do warrant closer review. The first one, which I found clients are just sort of now coming around to, is the expense reimbursement issue. Employees are incurring increased expenses as a result of COVID-19, whether it's in their technology that they need. So if you have employees that are working remotely for administrative functions, if you have employees that are, or even physicians that are working remotely for telehealth, there are inevitably going to be technology costs, Wi-Fi or internet service costs. There's going to be expenses, and it is time now to start thinking about what is the process going to look like to handle those expense reimbursements. A number of states do require that employers pay for any expenses that are required to do the job. As we get further into this thing, things that were short-term sort of emergency measures start looking like required expenses that employee has to pay and should be reimbursed for. Workplace accommodation policy reviews are definitely in order. The big issue there is going to be dealing with higher risk employees, and that could be employees who are 65 or older, or employees that have other health conditions. Probably not enough to simply have your standard workplace accommodation policy, given the scope and the magnitude of the pandemic that we're going through. It's really time for employers to look at establishing clear guidelines. If you're in with that higher risk group, what do you do? And what is the process and how does it work? Workplace harassment and discrimination training, it seems like a lifetime ago that Me Too was the headline every other day. Of course, workplace harassment and discrimination training is still important, but the focus appropriately needs to be specific to COVID-19 issues, among other issues. Things that we worry about, things that we're starting to see, are comments based on age. So we know that age is a higher risk group. Then you have to worry about how employees are going to perceive any comment that's age related, because, if you're an older worker in the healthcare setting, you're going to be worried that this condition, this pandemic could bring an early end to your career or to your health. So it's that the training specific to COVID-19 issues is critically important. Wage and hour compliance issues, as employees have to undertake and jump through more hoops to get in to work each day, you want to make sure that there's no risk of off-the-clock work, whether it's putting on or taking off PPE or going through temperature screening or symptom screening procedures. And lastly, and probably the big one that all institutions have been struggling with and are still working through, is just reviewing your leave of absence policies, ensuring that you're compliant with the new federal leave requirement, if that's applicable to you, if you have fewer than 500 employees, but also keeping an eye on state and local paid leave laws that are emerging, especially as part of these return to work orders. We expect to see more of that. And just making sure that you have a leave of absence scheme that addresses the common scenarios that didn't exist even a couple months ago, you know, whether that's allowing employees leave to care for school-aged children, quarantine, illness, all of those things. So a good time to start reviewing the policies, understanding that this is going to be a long-term situation. And now I will turn it over, talk about communications and marketing plans.
Thanks, Andy. And so after you have done all of this work planning for the resumption of non-emergent service lines in your hospital, we have to come around to the idea that we are now living in a world where your staff and your patients and the public at large may not feel safe coming to the hospital for procedures that they've been putting off, irrespective of their, you know, sort of the level of acuity of whatever condition they need treated. And so we do recommend sort of as a, you know, after you've done all the planning, coming around to a communications and marketing plan to help your, not just your patients, but your staff, practitioners, the community, on how to, and on why they should feel safe coming back to your facility. And that communication strategy should include, you know, that you have resumed certain service lines, where those service lines are available if you have multiple facilities, and communicating your hospital's comprehensive safety program so that they can get comfortable coming back to care. And so when thinking about this, we're going to think about the prioritization of service line resumption, the prioritization of scheduling. I recommend, or we recommend, giving training and a script to those that will be rescheduling services or scheduling services for these patients so that they can talk through with those patients what the hospital is doing to make sure that they are safe when they come in for the procedure. That could include things like the testing protocols that we discussed earlier. It could include, you know, the questions, the patients may have questions about the PPE, could have questions about the non-COVID care zones that you've developed, if you've developed off-site programs, that type of thing. So really arming your scheduling staff with the information so that they can allay any concerns that patients have as they're scheduling services. And then think about local media coverage and advertising and PR. You know, the hospital is typically sort of a trusted healthcare provider in the community, and really making sure that you are emphasizing and re-emphasizing that you are still the trusted healthcare provider in your community. And the focus that you've had on non-COVID related procedures and that patient and staff safety is still the top priority. And so all of the planning policies and procedures and everything that we've discussed should at some level get boiled down into a communications and marketing strategy that you can use to ensure your constituents, stakeholders, that it is safe to resume care. And it's safe to resume care in the hospital facilities, but where going into the hospital facilities are not necessary. That those services can be continued via telehealth or however you're performing those services at alternative sites now. So that will wrap up our content for today. We hope that you join us for part two on Wednesday. We're going to talk through some additional operational concerns for resuming care, mostly related to continued use of telehealth services through the resumption of services, data privacy and security issues that are coming up as a result of these things. And then to sort of talk through the financial considerations when reopening clinical service lines. We understand that a lot of hospitals are really struggling financially right now, even with the stimulus funds. There are still new financial considerations that need to be considered when reopening services. So, and then looking at payer strategy, evaluation of your current position and the like. We're also doing a section on innovation and opportunities, outlining while this crisis has been really horrible in a lot of ways, it's a good opportunity to assess, take a step back and assess what's really gone well. What are the changes in healthcare that have been made that we should stick with? How to leverage some of the changes you've made in your hospitals into more long-term meaningful changes and thinking about advocacy and rulemaking and working with the regulators on what that looks like. And so we hope that you register for that. And as noted before, there are resources on our blog and resources page, and then don't hesitate to reach out to our cross-department response team with any questions. And I'll turn it over to Emma to close us out.
Thank you, Bragg. And thank you for your participation today. A recorded version of this webinar will be available on the Pulse Nally website and COVID-19 blog within 24 hours. And as Bragg mentioned, if you have any questions regarding today's content, we encourage you to reach out to our COVID-19 support email. Thank you.